Accession number 16714, Richard Forbes, Reel 2.
Mr. Forbes, Reel 2. You joined the Territorial Army. What was the process of joining the Territorials?
Well, when I first went up and the CO said, right, we'll take you on for 6 months probation, I was issued with a uniform which consisted of a white drill jacket with brass buttons, white drill trousers, a peak cap, and boots. And for those 6 months, basically, I was attached to the machine gun platoon, as it was known then, and I was given basic training in square bashing under the eagle eye of the permanent staff instructor, which every TA unit had, of course, plus all the usual things of learning how to handle a rifle, fix bayonets, learn how to handle the Lewis machine gun, which is a terrible gun in actual fact. It was always jamming. So that was the first 6 months. And then, of course, in those 6 months, you sort of met informally and socially in the mess and learned how to conduct yourself and learn the mess etiquette was something which sometimes you put your foot right in it. For instance, if you were going into the mess, you always had to take your Sam Brown off as a symbol of removing any possibility of having your sword if you had an argument. And the other thing that we had in our mess was a very good rule, is nobody was allowed to stand drinks to anybody. Because if you got a young subaltern and he was cornered by, say, a major who had rather a thirst for gin and tonic, very soon a big mess bill would be run up. So the colonel would insisted on no treating of anybody. But if we had guests, of course, a different matter. And, of course, you just signed the chit and that was put on your mess bill at the end. So that was my introduction. And then at the end of the 6 months, I said, right, you are accepted. Then I filled in all the necessary forms. And ultimately, as I've just shown to you, my commission came back. And I was allocated to A Company under Captain Ritchie at headquarters in Gateshead. And that's how it all started.
Had you to have a medical?
Oh, yes. Well, in those days, of course, there was a medical officer who was attached to the battalion. But, of course, we were all so scattered. What we had to do, we had to go to our normal GP and go through all the particular medical checkups that were necessary, and he passes as fit. But, of course, at the time, all of us were very young, and, of course, those like me who played rugby and did other violent games were extremely fit, you see. So there wasn't any question of what's wrong with you. It was get in, sign there, and that's the end of it.
Had you to take an oath?
Yes, I took an oath as allegiance to His Majesty King George VI to serve him and all the rest of it. And then ultimately, of course, I was accepted informally by the colonel and formally by the commission, which you've just seen.
Can we talk for a little while longer, since you've brought it up, about the mess itself? How was it organised and run?
Well, the colonel was over all, but there was what the PMC ran it, the president of the mess committee, which is always the 2IC, in our case, Major Kelly. And he set the unwritten rules of how to behave yourself. For instance, if the colonel was in the mess before you went in, the first thing you did amongst all the crowd of officers chatting and drinking away, you'd force your way to the crowd, go to the colonel, bow, and say, "Good evening, sir." And he would say, "Hello, Forbes." And that was it. But if you omitted to do that, the 2IC would call you to one side after and say, "Look here, Forbes, you don't behave like that in this battalion." And that's all there was to it, you see. But, we had our little rules like that, and it was respect for each other that mattered. And also, really, respect for the rank. You don't salute a man or an officer, you salute the rank, because that represents a lot of history, a lot of tradition. Whoever happens to be wearing the uniform, it doesn't really matter. It's the attitude towards the individual that matters, you see. So that's how it was done. What else do we... yes, The rules were quite, and the same when we had guest nights. We always had to see to our guests first, of course, and ourselves second. And of course, when we had, do you want to know about guest nights at camp or that later on?
Well, we can deal with the mess and get it out the way now.
Right. Then, of course, we had social affairs. We'd always have a ball, We had one for the officers, where we'd invite the NCOs to join in as well. Then in reverse, the NCOs, the senior NCOs, they would organise a dance. They would invite us, and we always had the ladies there, of course, in long dresses, and we of course always wore mess kit, and we used to have these do's in the drill hall. There was a lot of intermingling in a sense between other ranks and officers of the TA. It is a bit of a delicate line to hold in a way. We had to be, what should we say, respectful to the others, and they had to be respectful to us. But at the same time, I had to hold the line that if we gave an order and that was it, you had to obey it. So you had to make sure that there was mutual respect, because if they didn't respect you and you gave out something which they didn't like, the ultimate thing, of course, is they could just walk off because they were territorials and just leave, you see. So you had to strike that balance of respecting them, being respected, but at the same time, the bottom line was, that's what you've got to do, you do it now or else. And that's how it worked. But etiquette, it was the PMC that did it. And then, of course...
And you paid mess fees, did you?
Yes, I don't know what you want to say. I've got some mess... Yes, we paid... You signed your chit for the... There was always a permanent waiter on duty. You signed your chit for what you had, and then he added them all up together and presented you with a mess bill. And woe any officer who didn't pay his mess bill. He was onto your bones straight away. He wouldn't allow anybody to run mess bills up, you see.
Who staffed the mess?
He was an ex sergeant, and Sergeant Weaver was his name, and he lived permanently at the drill hall. He had a little sort of set up there, and he used to serve the drinks and generally look after us, and it worked very well indeed. But you weren't allowed to treat each other. That was the most important thing.
You've mentioned the fact that you may have guests who you saw to yourselves. Were there any special occasions within the battalion, I'm thinking in terms of possibly historical, where you had a special evening or a...
Yes, well, we kept this for camp. At camp, we always used to invite ex-colonels and higher ranks, of course, to the guest night at camp, which we reserved entirely for them, and that's when they came along. And that was a special due. And then, of course, we had guest nights for the 6th Battalion and the 8th Battalion, where we invited their officers to come and join us. And that was the same thing there. But again, it always came back to the PMC, the 2IC, to control things and, you know, keep things in order and so on.
Did you have special occasions for certain historical occasions, such as battle honours or...
We always celebrated Inkerman Day as our day for our annual reunion, which is the Friday nearest to the 5th of November each day, Inkerman Day. And we kept that going right. Well, we still keep it going, of course.
Were you taught the traditions of the regiment and the battalion?
Well, you did in one sense, just by word of mouth. But the other thing is, in the drill hall was a great big screen, I remember. In fact, it wasn't a screen. It was like a picture frame of all the awards and decorations and brief history of the whole battalion, so that every recruit that came in, he could read that straight away to realise that he was joining some battalion with a lot of history behind it. And every recruit was given that booklet, which I think I gave you a copy, to keep, which gives them a brief history of the battalion, so that he knew what he was joining and what tradition he had to keep up to, you see.
So you came into the battalion as a second lieutenant.
That's right.
What were the initial expectations of a second lieutenant new to the battalion?
Well, first of all, it came down the line from the two IC to what was known as the senior subaltern. The senior subaltern would take all the young officers to one side, and he would give them exactly what they should do and what they shouldn't do, showing respect to the colonel, doing exactly what the adjutant said, doing what the permanent staff instructor said so far as drill is concerned, and so on. And he guided you on how to behave and what to do. And it was very good training in a way that, you know, he told you exactly how far you could go and how to behave yourself. And this applied particularly to alcohol, that if you went over the mark and made a nuisance of yourself, you'd perhaps get a warning. If you made another nuisance of yourself, you might even get chucked out altogether. and that was that was conducted by the colonel, the 2IC, and one other officer. And you know, it was decided on on the merits of the case whether you remain in the battalion.
A great deal of your initial experiences with the battalion were to do with what was expected you as a person amongst other persons.
It was really training you how to behave yourself, how to control other people, and control them with respect still remaining, which is a rather tall order. But that was really what they're trying to do. Whereas in the regular army, you see, right, you're a regular army officer, you've got your other ranks, you do this, and that was the end of it, full stop. If you got a bit of respect with it, fair enough. But in our case, with the territorial, you had to get the respect first, as well as, otherwise, it just wouldn't work, you see.
Is there any simple lessons as to how you got respect, or how you could get respect?
Yes.
From the other ranks and...
Well, the first thing was... was, let's put it this way, athletic prowess and physical fitness. In general, the other ranks didn't have the opportunities that we had. They perhaps play football, and well, that was probably about it, you see. They went to school where they probably left school at 14, had to work very, very hard, either down the pit or in factories or somewhere, or in shipyards, and the opportunities for sport and getting fit weren't there. Whereas the officers, on the other hand, of course, been right through school, played rugby, tennis, cricket, whatever it happened to be, you see. And in general, we're all a very, very fit lot. And of course, having in general a much better education, we could sort of set the pace and sort of set the tone for the others to follow. And that's really how we did it.
Did you take part with the other ants in these sports?
Yes. If there were sports days. Everybody was on the level. If you could play football well, you're on the football team. It didn't matter whether you're a major or a newly joined private soldier, you were on the football team. If it was boxing, the same thing there. If it was shooting, a shooting team on the indoor range, it wasn't a question of he's major so-and-so and he's only private so-and-so, who's the best shot? So you'd have company firing, shooting against each other, you see, that sort of thing. So everybody in certain activities was level off just like that. But then when it came to normal military activities, it's a question of officer and men doing as they're told, you see. And that's how you balance it out.
So a certain amount of respect between you through the sporting activities of the battalion.
Yes, well, you see, that thing that I showed you a photograph, that brigade open mile at Shilbottle, where I happened to come in first, it was only everybody could go in for it, you see, and I was the only officer. But because I'd always done an awful lot of running, was extremely fit, I just ran and I came in first. But that didn't matter. Everybody was on the same level and we all worked in together, you see. Because we all had a sports day at camp and everybody had a bash at something.
Outside of that part of the work, how did you gain respect from the normal face-to-face situation with other ranks?
Well, by treating them first of all as individuals, not talking down to them, showing them how you think it should be done, and then expecting them to follow. But if you could do it as well as, in most cases, better than they could doing their best, that was the thing to aim for. In other words, it was learning to learn how to drive a carrier or fire a rifle or strip down a machine gun. You had to be able to do that better or as well as or better than they could. So that meant a lot of extra private practice on your own part to show them that That's the standard to aim for. We're not telling you to do something which we couldn't do ourselves. That was the sort of basic principle.
Was listening to the men an important element?
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, about their concerns, military or social or whatever it was?
Well, we'd always be available for any private session. This applied, particularly to camp. If they had any personal problems, they could come to us and we would either deal with it ourselves or, if need be, take it up the line, you see, to perhaps the 2IC. It might be a sort of marital problem, maybe a financial problem, anything that came up, you see. They'll go to the officer, the platoon officer first, and then he might have a discussion with the sergeant, you see, and say, look, Sarge, what about this chap here? Is he okay at home? Is he drinking too much beer or is he a bit short of money? That sort of thing. And that would come to the sergeant, then to the platoon commander, then if need be up to the 2IC, you see. But you had to have this sense of comradeship and working together in the TA, because otherwise it just fell apart, you see. It's most important to have that.
I think you said you joined a company.
Yes, that was gated, you see.
Were you given a platoon in the company?
Yes, I was. Yes, after your initial training, you get a platoon straight away, you see. So, of course, you relied very heavily on the sergeant.
Do you recall the platoon number that you had?
Let's see. What? I can't offhand. It was. It would be three platoons. It'd be one, two, or three. I can't remember the number it was.
And how many men had you under you?
30 in round figures. Always 30 men, roughly. So that makes up. The company was roughly 100, you see. Three platoons. So each platoon was about 30. And then, of course, you had an additional one. You had the company sergeant major and platoon sergeant. So 30 to 35 in each platoon.
How was the platoon divided or subdivided?
In three sections. And each section usually had a lance corporal or a corporal. So I suppose this is where they got the threes from, you see. Whilst we're still doing form fours, it was still three. Three in a section, three in a platoon, you see, and three platoons in a company. That's how it worked. And of course, originally we were a three brigade division. But then just before the war, we changed to a two brigade division, motorised division, as you probably know. And that's how it all came about.
Before we come to that element, three sections. What were the composition of each section? Were they all riflemen?
Yes, they were all riflemen. And in theory, they should have had, just of course before when the war started, they should have had a Bren gun as well, each section. But of course that didn't happen because they just weren't there. So everyone had a rifle and ammunition, but that was it. We knew what we should have in the theory, but in practice we didn't have it until the war just started.
What kind of duties and responsibilities did you carry out in those initial months and year or so of the territories with your platoon?
Well, basically the first thing, of course, was drill. And what happened there was, first of all, we were probably drilled as a company under the permanent staff instructor, who was a regular army instructor, and he would train us in simple square bashing and all the rest of it, up and down, all the rest of it, to do things like that. And then later on, of course, we'd take our own platoons and learn how to command and control 30 men by doing the same thing. So you had companies, first of all, then split up into your three platoons, you see. Then you get fairly competent by controlling a platoon, and then the platoon would break off, and then the section leaders would get experience of controlling their little section. So ultimately, you see, when you sort of form yourself under sort of battle conditions, you'd had everybody taking responsibility for what they were really responsible for. And when you look back, it was quite a good system. So you're beginning to give responsibility progressively down the line, so that if anything happened, suppose the platoon commander was killed, you see, the sergeant would take over. The sergeant was killed, the lance corporal from one of the sections would take over, and if he was killed, the senior man in that platoon could take over, and so on. And you see, this is where the British Army scored over the Germans. The Germans were marvellous soldiers, provided they could do as they were told, when they were told, in that particular order, and so on and so on. But you disrupt that order, what should we do next? But with a British soldier, right, come on, Fred, let's get on with the job, you see. And that's how the terriers trained.
Do you recall your first company commander?
Yes, Captain Ritchie.
What was he like?
Marvellous man. I think he was an accountant. And he had a very sad end. He was shot during the BAF campaign. He was shot through the back. The wound hole closed, and the bullet landed just beside his heart. It was so close they couldn't do anything about it. And for ages they didn't know what was the matter with the man. He didn't feel very well, but they couldn't see anything wrong with him. So that's what it was. And he managed to get home. He was repatriated. And two or three years later, of course, he just suddenly died. But he was a marvellous man to us, real inspiration to us.
He'd have a 2IC. Do you recall who he was?
Yes, that was Major Kelly. And his son, of course, is David Kelly, lives up in Morpeth. It was Kelly's the printers he had. That was his business.
Battalion commander, who was that?
Colonel Simpson, W.S. Simpson.
Do you see much of him?
Well, he died about 2 years ago, I think at the age of 94. No, he originally came from Glasgow, and at the end of the war, he went back to where his roots were, as it were. He lived entirely the rest of his life up in Glasgow.
Was he a good commanding officer?
Oh, well, of course, he was First World War MC, And, you know, we absolutely thought the world of him, because with that wartime experience, you know, and he acted as our inspiration, because you had to, in the terrors, you had to have somebody to look up to, because without that, it was useless. So he was really good, Colonel Simpson.
Who was your platoon sergeant?
Platoon sergeant, Sergeant Jobson. He lived at Gateshead, a great, big, rough, gruff, efficient, get-it-done type of person. But he was a very, very good sergeant. A bit slow off the mark. But then later on, when the wars started, I began to get some younger NCOs, which were promoted to sergeant, and they were very, very much, not exactly more efficient, but quicker in the uptake, if you know what I mean. It was more difficult to teach the older ones. Of course, you see, when the war started, a lot of the old territorial officers and men, they were all weeded out, you see, because of physical disabilities, which have sort of gradually crept up on them over the years. But the fit ones that left, of course, stayed in.
What was the background to the men of your platoon?
Well, miners, labourers, working in factories, that sort of thing. But mostly miners there were. And particularly, of course, in when I was in D Company at Bladen, of course, they were, I would say, 100% miners, because we also had a small contingent at Chopwell. Have you heard of Chopwell? We had a contingent at Chopwell, which worked under the general command of D Company, and I would say 99% were miners. Now, there's one thing we had to do when the war started. In the First World War, whole families could be wiped out. So we had, I think, in D Company, I think there were three brothers in the company, and they had to, we separated them straight away. So they were all transferred to different companies for that reason. So that if any of them was killed, it wouldn't wipe the whole family out. Which was a very sad reflection on war, but there it is, that's what happened.
But yeah, how often, you went to camp once a year?
Yes.
How long for?
A fortnight's camp. And then officers, of course, went on special courses. And I did a fortnight's training at Fenham Barracks, which was shared with the RNF, Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, and the DLI. They shared that barracks. And there again, I started again at the bottom. I was put in the regular army squads doing literally square bashing, which I found very, very hard physically. And then the roles were changed. Right, Forbes, you're in charge of that. Not get on with it, you see. You start drilling them. And, of course, this was the opportunity of the soldiers to pull our legs. So when they were marching across the barrack yard and they were approaching the wall, I would say, about turn, you see, and the sergeant would say, don't about turn, just keep firing on to see what he does, you see. And, of course, then I had to stop them and turn them around and all the rest of it. But it was good training to learn how to shout and get a command right across a great big barrack square and to get the men to obey. Then, of course, the officers told us a lot about strategy and field training and so on, so that when we went back to our TA battalion, we could start training our own platoon in how to move across ground, how to make the best use of cover and all the rest of it, you see.
Was this still World War One orientated?
There were regular army officers orientated to what was then modern method. In other words, they were all pretty young. In fact, I can't remember a single First World War officer at Fenham Barracks, but they were all regular army officers, you see. And then, of course, we had to learn a lot of their mess etiquette. And one of the things I had to learn, I had to very rapidly get some visiting cards made, because the first custom is, wherever a stranger went in to the mess, he had to put his card on a little silver tray to say that Forbes R8 of 9DLI had called today, and then sign the visitor's book. So that was a little bit of etiquette they had. But no, they were very good, the regular army officers, recognising that we had got a part to play. That was one thing I always found with all DLI officers, regular in particular, they did not talk down to the territorial officers. Now, some regiments did this. Oh, he's only a TA chap, we'll not bother with him very much. But the DLI officers never did that. They just treated you as equals and gave you the best of their ability and time and experience, which, of course, is the best way of training people.
Can we look at camps now? You say once a year. What time of the year did you have your camp?
Well, of course, we always did it to suit most people. It's usually around about August. Now, because I worked for ICI, they were very generous ICI, they allowed us to territorial officers and men to take that fortnight off and not count it as holidays, and we were paid. But it was usually in August, and we went away for a fortnight's camp.
And the places would vary, did they not?
Well, the first one I went to was Whitby, and the next one I went to was Shilbottle up in near Alnwick, which is not far away from Colonel Sell lives now. So they were the only two I managed to squeeze in before the war came. But in between time, I had a fortnight's course at the Royal Military College, which was quite an experience for me, where we were just trained like regular army officers there. And that was very, very intensive and hard. But this was just in 1939, you know, when we realised the war was going to go. So everybody had to go through RMC and learn as much as they can.
What were the usual activities of the camp?
Oh, the camp. Right, first thing, well, the usual thing, rise up early, get your breakfast on parade. Then there's always a route march, the first thing you did, because the main objective, in a short space of time, to get the men as fit as possible. So it had to be really hard physical work to sort out some of the weedier ones and get them extra training. So it was always a route march in the morning, and which was pretty hard going to start off with. You see, we were all pretty fit, but you see, the men weren't used to this, particularly with their feet. So we'd do we'd march in the morning. I don't know how far we'd go, but at any rate, it was pretty hard going. So by the time we'd finished at lunchtime and come back to camp, you didn't think you could take everything off and relax. The first job was foot inspection. Everybody had to take their boots and socks off and inspect their boots, and we had to go along and look at these filthy feet. And if there's anything wrong with them, of course, we had to put them onto the medical officer to get attention. And then in the afternoon, we'd had our meal. There was always exercises of some sort, either in the camp or doing field exercises of making best use of ground, that sort of thing, you see. And then in the evening, there'd be sports and competitions, either amongst ourselves or with the men. And then, of course, it was lights out, and then they repeat the same process the next day. And then once, towards the end of the second week, we'd do joint exercises with the other two battalions as a brigade. We didn't do brigade and brigade exercises at the terrier level. It wasn't until 1939 where we were going to go in as a division with the regular army, and instead of TA camp on that basis, of course, the war came and that was it. And we got some real practice. But that was the basic thing, to do the hard slog in the morning to really get fit, because marching for several hours, you soon find out what your weaknesses are. And, of course, without decent feet, of course, you're no good at all.
Training and drills and marching, so were these at light infantry pace?
Oh, yes, everything was light infantry. there's no question of sloping arms, that sort of thing. And it's the same in the drill hall. We're doing the square batting the drill hall. It's all light infantry drill we did, which in some ways is a bit awkward compared to the ordinary infantry of sloping arms, but that's the way we did it.
You mentioned field training there that you did at camp. Was that based on fire and movement?
Based on fire and movement, basically. And the most important thing we tried to get into their heads was the use of ground, even a slight dip in the ground, a bit of a bush, obscure line of sight from where the enemy should be. There may be perhaps a branch of a tree jutting out, and you've got to imagine there's a chap behind on the other side there taking a sight on you. If there's a branch of a tree in the way, it might sort of alter a sight. So all these things we had to try and point out. It isn't just a piece of ground, it's cover from which to defend yourself or from which to attack. So we gradually got these ideas across into the men's heads, and so that when they were on their own with the officer being killed, they weren't sort of left completely naked and just shot down. So it was all part of the training.
And the camp was under canvas?
All under canvas, that's right. And we all had, of course, we had our own cooks as well. But fortunately, a lot of the those that are the ranks that joined the territorial were cooks in Civvy Street, you see. So, of course, they went as cooks. We used to make some very, very good meals indeed. But there again, you see, cooks weren't allowed to hide behind their blooming pots and pans without picking up a rifle and firing. They had to come out too, the same as the band. The band, of course, were trained as infantry soldiers, but of course they had to learn first aid under the authority of the medical officer, because in wartime, of course, the band became stretcher bearers and so on, you see. So Doc Rutherford used to take the band to one side and give them sort of basic medical training. They play the band for us in the evenings, and play the band for us going down West Street, Gateshead. And at the same time, had to do the normal. Every band had, of course, fire a standard shooting minimum qualification every year, but otherwise you wouldn't be paid for camp, you see. So everybody had to be a pretty good shot. And the regular army just recently have found out that so many cooks and other people completely failed the standard firing qualification. They can't fire a blooming rifle.